This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Lucy Moore. Lucy is a mediator and consultant specializing in natural resource and public policy disputes. She works on both regional and national cases, often with a multicultural or tribal component, and is author of Into the Canyon, 7 Years in Navajo Country. Lucy Moore is here today to tell us about her most recent book, Common Ground on Hostile Turf, Stories from an Environmental Mediator, published in 2013. Welcome, Lucy.
Thank you, Diane. It's a pleasure to be here.
What led you to write your book, Common Ground? What is your purpose?
You know, there were several things. I've been in this business for 25 years, so I naturally have been collecting a lot of stories. And for me, stories are at the heart of conflict resolution. If I can allow people, give them the space and provide a safe forum in which they can tell their stories to each other, we can get somewhere. So over the years, I have a lot of good stories, and they were kind of bubbling up in me, and I really needed to get them out and on paper so that other people could enjoy those stories of how people work with conflict and get through it. And I think another reason why I wanted to write the book is that the mediation profession has grown a lot in the last couple of decades, become kind of a legitimate field, especially in environmental mediation is now an actual course you can take in graduate school, you can get degrees. And as such, it has gotten a lot of jargon associated with it and got a little bit too pleased with itself, I might say. And I wanted to try to bring our field down to earth and remind other mediators and conflict resolvers of what really counts. And for me, that is getting people together, allowing for that human-to-human connection to happen, and then proceeding with the resolution of the conflict.
Well, you've been alluding to this, but what is the role of a mediator?
Aha, good, thank you. The mediator, as opposed to an arbitrator or a judge, because a lot of people are confused about that, a mediator will never make the decision in a dispute. The mediator will never say, this is the right side, this is the wrong side, this is what's going to happen. So the mediator helps the parties that are in conflict with each other come to their own resolution. It's a process of helping people express what it is they need and figure out what it is that will work for all of them together.
What are the key elements of a successful mediation?
You know, that's harder than it might sound. And I think this may be what I'm alluding to when I talk about the profession getting maybe a little too professional. I think a lot of people in the profession would say, oh, well, I can tell you, you begin with the assessment phase, and then you move on to identifying the needs, and then you generate the interests, and then you create solutions. And I actually don't think that's the correct answer. I think a successful mediation comes from allowing people to be vulnerable with each other, to open up to each other in an honest way, to tell each other what they really need and why they need it from this particular situation. And the mediator can then help the parties move forward to identify what might work as a solution. But without that first step of human-to-human connection, we're not going to get very far. We will get bogged down in data battles and detours into legal technicalities and things that really don't have to do with the resolution of the conflict.
Would you give examples of how connecting at a human level helped reveal common ground and assisted the mediation process?
Sure. One of the stories I tell in the book, the chapter's actually called The Power of the Story, because I believe that was the key to resolving it. This was a conflict that involved the National Association of Counties, which is a big organization that represents every county employee in the country. So there are tens of thousands of members, and they are a lobbying organization for all those county representatives. So this was several years ago. Some of the counties in the West became really frustrated because they had tribal jurisdictions within their county boundaries, and they felt that this was not fair, in a sense, that they could not tax tribal lands in certain ways, and they just became extremely frustrated. and they proposed that tribal treaties be abrogated, in other words, be done away with. In other words, they said, it's time that Indians grew up and joined the rest of the country, and why should they have special entitlement and special status? And this, of course, caused a huge row within the organization. So they put together a task force of half tribal members of NACO, in other words, tribal people who are also county office holders, because there are a lot of those in the country too, and half from those counties that were wanting to get rid of the treaties. They met, I think it was about six times, without any kind of help, any kind of facilitator, and they became entrenched in hating each other. I read the minutes of those meetings, and over, they just went after each other in the most repetitive way, getting nowhere. So they finally decided maybe they should get a mediator to help. They had one more meeting to go, and that was it. So I was called in. I arrived at the meeting. It was in Denver, and walked into the room, and here were these people that already were really dug in to their positions and not happy to be there. And I thought, well, gosh, I don't know really how I'm going to help these people, but I need to know who they are first. So I asked for introductions. And I just started around the table and I said, you all know each other, I'm sure, but I don't know you, so please introduce yourselves. And they began around the table, and the first two were non-Indian county officials from different parts of the West, and they made introductions that lasted about, oh, maybe 12 seconds. And I thought, oh dear, this is going to be over very, very soon, and I'm going to have to get down to business, and I'm not quite sure how to approach this, but I'm sure it will work out. Well, the third person in line was a small, elderly Indian woman from the Southwest, and she took my invitation to introduce herself very seriously, and she began in a kind of typical way. She said, do you know where Tuba City, Arizona is? And everybody looked blank. These are people that had spent hours with each other, and she was offering a new question. And she said, well, that's where I was born. And she began her story in the most leisurely, detailed way of being raised by her grandmother because her mother was an alcoholic. Her husband was killed while he was working on the radio. She was left with four small children. She finally got an associate's degree. She just had a very, very hard life. And her sister-in-law convinced her to run for county commission in the county in which they lived. And by this time, she had been going on over 20 minutes of her introduction. And I thought, oh, gosh, this is going to throw off my entire schedule. And I looked around at the other people to see whether anybody was impatient looking at their watches. And I found everyone was entranced with her story, as was I. She wrapped up by saying that she was elected to the county commission, and she chuckled. And she said, when I went into that meeting to take my seat for the first time, I couldn't believe how big those chairs were. She said, you know how big those big leather chairs are for the county commissioners? And everybody chuckled and nodded their heads because they all knew what she was talking about, these kind of overblown official, county official chairs. And she said, I never was so scared in my life as when I walked up there, me, a little Indian lady, to be a county commissioner, but I'm really glad I did, and now I've served three terms. So that was basically the end of her story. And interestingly enough, after that, we went to have lunch, and when we came back, the whole tenor was different. The rest of the people introduced themselves as well, of course. So by the time we were done, people had a real sense of who each other was, and when we came back, people said, I don't think this is really about treaties. I don't think this is really about county jurisdiction. I think we can work this out. We're all so different. You know, listen to all these stories we heard. We're so different. We'll just have to deal with this on a case-by-case basis and understand that this is difficult. There were several hours of discussion, but that was what people concluded in the end. It was an incredible breakthrough, a real lesson for me in allowing that kind of human expression and connection to happen.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Lucy Moore, author of the book Common Ground on Hostile Turf, Stories from an Environmental Mediator. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. How important is unequal power of participants in affecting the outcome of mediation?
Power is a very big subject, Diane. Thanks for asking that. We say as mediators that one of our jobs is to equalize power at the table somehow. And that can be very difficult if you have a utility company sitting there and a small tribal community, for instance, or you can imagine an environmental nonprofit organization fighting a mining company. The power can be off balance. So what we try to do is ensure that at least at the table, the power is equal. In other words, one side cannot overcome the other, cannot browbeat or act disrespectfully or insult or make the other side feel small in any way. At least in our setting, the parties have equal voice and are treated equally and must treat each other with equal respect. So that's one thing we do. I've seen some remarkable shows of power because, of course, power is what is at play in the resolution of the dispute. You can't help but think that if you can get the upper hand, which would be more powerful, you could get your way. And I have seen some remarkable creative ways of those that have a lot less power exerting power over very powerful people through use of another language, for instance, use of certain tribal traditions to put non-Indians in an uncomfortable position. There's some very creative ways people can try to equalize their own power.
Would you give an example of how cultural differences can keep a solution from moving forward?
I think culture is an interesting word. I work a lot with tribes because I lived in Navajo country for almost 8 years and developed a kind of credibility among Indian communities around the country through that experience and through my work. And so we often think of culture as tribal culture or Hispanic culture. I also do a lot of work with those communities. Culture can be a factor. For instance, I'll give an unusual example. I had a case with the Army Corps of Engineers, and I found that the Army Corps of Engineers culture was a real problem, and that indeed they had a culture that was very powerful. And that culture was based on a kind of a military model. And so the colonel who was representing the Army Corps in this case, he was trying to expand a reservoir against the wishes of some Hispanic villagers that lived nearby and would have lost some land as a result of it. And his idea was to approach that community in a very rigid and official and legalistic and militaristic way so that he would state what it was that the U.S. government needed and how they were about to do it. And fortunately, I had some time to work with him before we met with the community. And that was extremely helpful because I was able to convince him. At first, it was difficult to convince him that he should take a softer approach, that he should really listen to what the community had to say before he came forth with his declarations. And hopefully, he might not come forth with those declarations. He really didn't want to do that. He said, I have my duties, and this is what my duties are. And then I reminded him that he had hired me and that I was actually the expert in this particular process and that he had better take orders from me because I kind of used his culture, this order-taking culture, I used it in order to help him be more the type of negotiator that I thought would be successful. And this case is in the book, and it really has a very wonderful ending. It worked well.
What are some examples from your book of personalities having a key effect on the outcome of mediation?
In every single case, every single story, there are strong personalities. It just is inevitable when people are in conflict and passionate and have a lot at stake. And I think what's interesting is that some people go in a heroic direction, and some people don't. Some people are so overcome with fear that they cling to what they have and can't open up and can't take chances. So for me, the real heroes are those that take a risk. And there are several in the book. There's an Indian leader in the book who, although his tribe was in the middle of a huge water rights controversy with the neighboring non-Indian communities, and although his tribe was really reviled by those non-Indian communities, he had the courage to, because of his quirky kind of egocentric personality, he had the courage to just stand up and call a meeting of all of his neighbors, Indian and non-Indian alike, and say, we have water contamination problems aside from water rights, and we're going to fix them now. And I don't want to hear one word about water rights, because that's not what this is about. So you come here and let's sit down and let's figure this out. Very, very powerful personality. He took a lot of risk that he would be seriously criticized, insulted, all kinds of things. And he made it happen with the power of his personality, Governor Villarreal outside Santa Fe.
Would you speak about the issue of trust, its importance, and how you go about building it?
Trust is critical, and we can all imagine how hard it is to build trust. Just think about people you truly trust. There probably aren't that many out there. And so for me as a mediator to try to build trust among participants that have come together because they are in deep conflict with each other over something very dear to them sounds impossible. And I'm not saying that total trust can be built. Of course it can't. But enough trust can be built within that group to carry forward on the subject that we need to talk about. And that kind of trust, again, comes from making a human connection with the other person. And making that human connection can often happen by telling your story. If you can courageously, like that Indian woman county official, open up and tell your story to somebody that is really on the other side, you can then empower and encourage that person to do the same. And once that happens, you've made yourself vulnerable and nothing bad has happened. The person hasn't lunged across the table at you. That is the beginning of trust. You're entrusting each other with your story, whatever it might be. And then you see the glimmer of that common ground. Then they can begin to see that the point is not to hate this other person. The point is to actually find what it is you can share together within that conflict. Wow, we both really, really do care about that piece of land, don't we? And once you begin to realize that, of course you want to do different things with that piece of land, but that doesn't mean you don't care about it. So let's talk about the caring of that land and why and where that comes from. That can be the source of some of those stories that build trust as well.
Could you give a specific example?
Yes, I had a really significant case for me early in my career that involved a wool growers cooperative. This was a sheep herding community in northern New Mexico, and they found themselves in a situation where their traditional grazing lands had been taken away from them. And they were so frustrated after several seasons, several summers of not being able to graze their sheep, they feared they would go out of business and that would really be the end of their community. It would turn into a ghost town. So they staged a graze in and moved their sheep, several thousand sheep, into a wildlife management area that was managed by the state for the protection of elk. And when they had a press conference and said, this is what we've done, you'll have to come in and get us, and this is a serious matter. We're just trying to draw attention to the fact we need to find some grazing land. The environmental community in New Mexico went ballistic. They were enraged that sheep, which they consider to be incompatible with wildlife, they believed that the sheep, their grazing patterns were destructive to the land, and they insisted that the governor call out the National Guard and get those evil sheep out of the wildlife management area. The governor didn't want to do that. The sheep community had press conferences and had little children holding baby lambs. So eventually I was asked with a colleague to come in and try to mediate this situation. And what we did was we brought together six members of that community and six environmental leaders in the state to sit down. And we said that our goal would not be to solve the grazing problem because that was just too hot and too controversial, but could we at least begin to understand each other and start to have a conversation with the two sides, which might then lead to something? That was our goal. And what we found in that first meeting, which was kind of an intense 3-day retreat with those 12 people, was that once they began to tell the story to each other, and what we did was we posed very specific questions to them and let them go in separate groups, the community in one direction, the environmentalists in the other, and plan a presentation that they would make to the other side about their feelings for the land, the value they held in the land, what they wanted the other side to know about them, and how they wanted to be treated in this three-day conversation that was coming up. And that exchange of presentations was extremely powerful as they really listened intently to each other and heard what the land meant to each of them and began to identify the differences where the environmentalists said, "We care about the land too. Well, you know, we care just as much as you do." And the community said, "Oh, no, you don't. You just told me you moved from Philadelphia. You came here from Seattle. If you cared that much about your land, you would have stayed on your land. And it is not the same. We have been here for hundreds of years, literally, and we are not going anywhere. And so our attachment to the land is very different from yours." And that point was made with a field trip that we took and in other ways, but that common understanding of different ways of valuing that land was what began to bring that group together. And they did eventually work on a joint project together, which was very impressive given the hostility in the beginning.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Lucy Moore, author of the book Common Ground on Hostile Turf, Stories from an Environmental Mediator. How do you handle the situation when one or more members of a mediation group aren't acting in good faith?
You just go home and cry. That is the toughest, Diane. It is just the toughest. And of course, it's not always easy to tell whether they're acting in bad faith or not. In two different cases I've had, I didn't really realize it until the very end. One case went on for 4 years, and one went on for 2.5 years. And toward the end, what we do in mediation is test for consensus. Consensus can be defined in a lot of different ways. I like to define it as unanimity. So if you say consensus means, well, most of the people agree, but a few people don't, then you have totally disempowered those few people who don't. And I really want to give equal power to everyone at the table. If consensus equals unanimity, then everyone at the table has got an equal voice and everyone has got the equal power to veto. And you just pray and trust and work at it so that nobody vetoes, so that the solution, the agreement that is on the table, has enough in it to satisfy everybody at the table. Nobody may be completely happy, but everybody can live with that solution. And in these two cases, I did not realize until we went around to test for consensus. Can you live with this agreement? Yes, I can. Can you live with this agreement? Yes, I can. And we came to somebody at the table who said, no, I cannot. And try as we would to fix the agreement to satisfy her by doing all kinds of things that really were in her interest, in the interest she was representing, we were moving in her direction. She gave absolutely no indication that she would ever give consensus, and she never did. And that was bad faith, and it was very difficult for me, more difficult for the group.
What is success? How do you decide if a mediation was successful?
You can't help but want a nice, concrete, signed agreement in ink and that you could put in your drawer and admire frequently. And I will tell you that that does not happen very often. And people are often shocked at that. You know, well, my gosh, what are you doing? You must not be very good. Isn't that depressing to not be able to reach agreement, like the case I just talked about? And actually, the interesting thing for me is that I have to think a lot about which cases were successes and which were not successes by that measure. Because for me, the success is really in the relationship that is built at the end of the process by what has been learned by everybody, by the degree of trust that has been built. And in these cases, there is almost always a government agency that is the actual decision maker. For instance, I had a case where the problem was air noise over Grand Canyon from those air tours, helicopters, and fixed-wing planes. And the noise had gotten so bad that it was really a problem for recreators and those that wanted some quiet at Grand Canyon. So I mediated a process for 4 years that involved bringing together the environmentalists, the recreators, the airplane companies, the helicopter companies, the FAA, and the Park Service at Grand Canyon. Now, the Park Service was responsible for making the rules about the air tours, but if this group could have made those rules by consensus, and we spent a very long time developing those rules, the Park Service said, we will take your rules and we will adopt them. They will be ours. If you can do it by consensus, every single person agreeing, we will take those and make them ours. A very powerful incentive for any group to reach consensus. In spite of that, there was a bad faith person at the table who was unable to give consensus. And there are reasons why. By saying bad faith, I don't want to say this is a bad person. This is not a bad person. In this particular case, this person represented an organization that had told her, do not give in on anything at all. Her hands were tied. So at the end, she was unable to agree to this set of rules that everybody thought we had agreement on. And so it was a failure in that sense. But the Park Service took a good deal of the work that we had done and crafted their rules based on a lot of those difficult discussions and decisions that we had made. And actually, at the end of that process, everybody was quite content. There was grouchiness that we were lacking one person for consensus, but everybody felt that so much had been learned and that it was a very valuable process. So I call that one a success. Others would say, oh no, Lucy, you can't put that one in that pile because you didn't get full consensus.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Work hard to listen to each other carefully in ways that you may not have listened to before. Open up your ears, your mind, and your heart, and let somebody else's story come to you in a new way. Try to build that trust, particularly with those that you may have problems with. And I'm not talking big environmental problems. I'm talking anybody out there in a tough situation, personally, professionally, whatever. Try to take some deep breaths, make that human connection with that other person. Take a chance, take a little chance. Say something that might surprise that person and see where you go with it. And you might be surprised.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Lucy.
Thank you, Diane. It was a pleasure.
You are just listening to Lucy Moore, author of the book Common Ground on Hostile Turf, Stories from an Environmental Mediator, published in 2013 by Island Press. For more information, check on the web at lucymooreassociates.com. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.